What the hell is going on right now? And why is it happening like this? At Wired, we're obsessed with getting to the bottom of those questions, and maybe you are too. I'm Katie Drummond, the Global Editorial Director of Wired, and I'm hosting our new podcast series, The Big Interview. Each week, I'll sit down with some of the most interesting, provocative, and influential people who are shaping our right now. Listen to The Big Interview right now in the same place you find Wired's Uncanny Valley podcast.
It's early days for the ceasefire in Gaza. The head of one humanitarian aid group says there has been some progress.
Pressure has to be continued. We can't lift foot off the pedal. I'm pushing to ensure that enough aid is going in.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We'll also hear about deadly clashes along the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan.
We are at the crossroads between escalation and a war that could become problematic, not just for the two countries, but also for the region.
Plus, a company in a landlocked state takes aim at ocean plastic.
Recycling's never going to be super lucrative. It is more of a public service.
And hear from the reporter who tracked down one of the most wanted men in Europe.
Once you show him in the streets of Moscow, they can no longer say, oh, we don't know where he is.
All that and more today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. The ceasefire in Gaza is holding up, mostly. There are already questions, though, about one of the early requirements in the U.S.-brokered peace plan, the flow of humanitarian aid to Palestinians in Gaza. It's supposed to be surging right now.
But it's not, according to Christian Cardon, spokesperson for the International Committee of the Red Cross.
The answer is no, not yet. The shift has not yet happened. We are still witnessing only few trucks coming in and large crowds approaching these trucks in a way that is absolutely not conform to humanitarian standards.
To learn more about what's happening with aid in Gaza, we reached out to Sean Carroll. He's the head of a relief group called ANIRA, American Near East Refugee Aid. It has extensive experience working in the Gaza Strip. I started by asking him how much aid is getting in now.
Not enough yet, and it's hard to tell exactly how much. I mean, there is more than had been coming in before, and obviously more than what was coming in during an 11-week stretch in early March through late May, where absolutely nothing came in. So it has gradually stepped up, but it's not where it's supposed to be according to the agreement. It's not where it was during several weeks of surge aid during the last ceasefire when they were allowing exactly 700 trucks a day, 6 days a week, so an average of 600 a day over the course of a week. And when you have an exact number every day, that shows you could do even more than that. So I think that what we would want to see is that what is allowed in is what meets the demand, and we're not there yet.
And that 600 trucks a day is what the ceasefire plan or the 20-point agreement spells out. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. What conditions, if any, is Israel placing on the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza?
Well, I think it's a question of are all five borders open, border crossings open like they're supposed to be? Have they increased the number of hours? Have they increased the personnel? Is there enough fuel? The Israeli authorities are reporting that they've increased the number of trucks, and that which includes fuel, but I think we're not seeing the full surge yet. And there are other restrictions. Some organizations are restricted from bringing aid in, or some can bring in aid, but it's not clear where they can distribute it. And so there are bureaucratic, political, logistical, and of course the damage from the war is also a factor. Although I have to say, with the partial withdrawal of troops and with the ceasefire, our staff have been able to move around more quickly. Movements from north to south that used to take half a day or longer can now be done in half an hour to an hour. And so that's an improvement. Both major arteries are open. They're damaged from the war, but they're both open. So this should be able to be done. And there's enough capacity and willingness on the inside and definitely on the outside, donor countries, governments, foundations, individuals, all saying, how can we help? We want to help. And we're seeing it around the world, a surge in interest in being able to meet this moment. And it is a moment. There's a ceasefire that's long awaited. But at the same time, there are still people who are malnourished, or severely malnourished, and at jeopardy of dying from malnutrition. And we need to get food in, and we need to get nutritional supplements in, and we need to get medicine in.
I know that there are specific protocols and supplies needed to re-nourish people who have been starving. Can you tell me about that process and what those supplies are?
You know, they're ready-to-eat nutritional supplements. A commercial name, Plumpy Nut, is one of them. They have to be properly, the diagnosis and the intervention have to be medically supervised because you can have the problem that people who've been starving are overfed, and that can be life-threatening as well. So it's a particular product. There are several versions of it, but it's a particular product that has to be medically supervised and is absolutely critical to stave off starvation, particularly among babies and children.
Yeah, is that something that's getting into Gaza, and is it being supplied along with the necessary medical professionals to administer it?
Some is, but there have been delays, and there's not enough of it. And there's, like with much of the other needed aid, there's plenty of supply. There's plenty of desire and supply to get it in, and it's a question of the speed and the hurdles. Those hurdles need to come down, and we need to act with alacrity, and that speed just has to come up.
Is international pressure from places like the EU, the UN, the US likely to influence the speed or amount of aid that is being allowed into Gaza?
It needs to be. I mean, the pressure on more aid has been pretty consistent from many governments for a long time. You know, listeners might ask, well, then why we have such a problem here? I think that pressure has to be continued. We can't lift foot off the pedal on pushing to ensure that enough aid is going in. And it does seem to be mostly political. Sure, there are logistical hurdles, but now that there's a ceasefire, that's a major impediment out of the way, although our staff and everyone else was operating under fire and risking their lives every day. But obviously, it makes it easier and safer now under a ceasefire. And there's certainly willingness, and there's human capital, there's capacity to deliver. So it's really just a question of making sure that enough crossings are open, that they're open enough hours, that there's enough personnel, and that the barriers on inspection and entry are lowered. Everyone understands any commercial and aid shipments around the world has to be cataloged. You have to have the inventory, you have to have security checks, but those restrictions need to be loosened in order for the amount of aid that's needed to get in. And that's what happened in the last ceasefire, and it absolutely has to happen now.
But it has not yet happened.
Not fully. I think, you know, you do have dueling narratives, but it hasn't fully. I mean, we're definitely not at the level of 600 or 700 trucks a day.
Sean, what would you see as a sign that things are moving in the right direction in the coming days?
Well, that the amount of aid that needs to come in is coming in, and it's coming in because there's a willingness to make it happen. In the early part of this war on Gaza and after, there were many in the Israeli government calling for aid not to go in, and there were stoppages in the beginning and then the 11-week period where nothing was going in. And so I think that's what the world's looking for. Has there been a switch that recognizes that this deal includes not just the ceasefire and the withdrawal of troops and a solution to Hamas, but also the amount of aid that civilians are in jeopardy, life-threatening circumstances for many of them? And is there a recognition that for a better future, for a chance at peaceful coexistence, there has to be aid and commercial goods as well? We need to get back to some normalcy that hasn't been there for a long time. And it's not going to come anytime soon because, of course, it's not just a question of how many trucks come in. It's a question of, are we on the path to recovery and reconstruction, which includes so much. It's so much. And so I think people are looking at what is the political will, what is the adherence to the agreements from all sides to be sure that this continues moving in what in the last few days has obviously felt like a positive direction.
Sean Carroll is with the aid group ANIRA, American Near East Refugee Aid. He spoke with us today from the UK.
The border between Afghanistan and Pakistan has been the scene of fighting between the two countries lately. Both sides claim that dozens of fighters were killed over the weekend. The Taliban, who control the government in Afghanistan, said that Pakistan also targeted the capital, Kabul, with airstrikes last week. And they say that attacks on Pakistan border posts were carried out in retaliation. This marks a serious escalation between the two countries. Omar Samad has been following the situation closely. He served as Afghanistan's ambassador to Canada and France and is now with the Atlantic Council in Washington.
This is probably one of the most intense situations that has emerged, not only because Pakistani flying objects, because we're not exactly sure whether they were planes or drones, flew over Kabul, and there were some loud bangs. We don't know exactly whether they were rockets or bombs or just noise. And that shook the whole population in the city of more than 6 million people. But then we do know for a fact that they actually did bombard some Afghan territories along the Durand Line, and that there were some casualties. And that sort of led to the response by the Taliban, who attacked about a dozen or so Pakistani military posts. And there have been dozens of casualties. We don't have exact numbers, but dozens of casualties on both sides.
I mean, the lack of clarity on those strikes is interesting. Pakistan has neither confirmed nor denied carrying out airstrikes on Kabul. Help us understand, though, what interest Pakistan would possibly have in doing something like that.
Well, it could also be to intimidate, to send a message that things can get worse, that we have the ability and the means to strike. You don't have the ability because Afghanistan's air force is basically dormant. The air defenses also are not very active. So Afghanistan relies on a ragtag army of former militants, the Taliban, who now have formed new units. But it's rudimentary, not that it's a guerrilla warfare type situation or conventional. So Pakistan wanted to send a message, I think, that they are very serious about this TTP phenomena, which is the Taliban of Pakistan, that is a threat to what Pakistan says is its security. And they accuse Afghanistan of either harboring them or supporting them or giving them refuge. And Afghanistan denies and says, well, you need to provide proof because we do not do that.
So to that point, Ambassador, the TTP, the Pakistani Taliban, do the Taliban in Afghanistan control the TTP? Do they give them orders, or are they fairly autonomous?
Ironically, TTP emerged as a militant outfit, anti-Pakistan state militant outfit, around 2014-15. And at the time, the Pakistani military establishment supported it in order to make sure that they could help the Afghan Taliban fight the Americans and Kabul's government at the time. Mm. And so Pakistan, ironically, helped support this group, which then turned against its interest. And the Taliban of Pakistan have their own agenda. They have their own qualms with Islamabad about how they're running the tribal regions. So the Afghans are saying, you guys need to talk to each other. You're both Pakistanis. This is an internal issue. And why are you meddling with our affairs? And why are you getting us involved into your Pakistani issues? So please, if you can help, we will help. If you want us to set up talks and mediate, we will do that. But don't blame us for what's happening inside Pakistan.
So looking to Pakistan's eastern border, there was a brief but worrisome conflict between Pakistan and India back in May of this year. Right now, the Taliban's foreign minister is in India for a week-long trip. What kind of message does that send to Pakistan?
Well, obviously, the Pakistanis are upset about it. But why should they be upset? This is a bilateral relationship between Afghanistan and India. It is not geared towards Pakistan or anti-Pakistan. It's a totally different set of historic relations that we've had for hundreds of years with India.
I mean, do you see it as a case of the enemy of my enemy is my friend now?
Well, I mean, you can look at it from that perspective. I mean, remember, 4 years ago, 3 years ago, just until a few months ago, the Indians were very anti-Taliban. They did not like what had happened. They considered the Taliban as being too pro-Pakistan. Everybody considered the Taliban as being too pro-Pakistan because the Taliban had found refuge in sanctuaries in Pakistan for all those years. But then the Taliban have realized that Pakistan is trying to impose its will. It's trying to use its weight in order to push Afghanistan to maybe support its agenda, its strategy in the region. And Afghanistan, under the Taliban, don't feel like they want to do this because they don't want to get involved with anybody else's wars.
As a temperature check, Ambassador, how serious are you taking what's happening along the border and any concerns that you have that this could escalate into full-out war?
There is that risk. We are at a crossroad right now after this tit-for-tat that took place in the past 3-4 days. This could get out of hand if not controlled, if both sides don't agree and have the political will to pursue a diplomatic channel, again, either bilaterally or through a third party. So we are at the crossroads between escalation and a war that could become problematic, not just for the two countries, but also for the region, or addressing the key issues through political talks. And I hope that the latter path will be taken.
Ambassador Omar Samad is with the Atlantic Council in Washington. He's been explaining what's behind recent deadly clashes along the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan. This is The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. One part of the U.S. government that's long been serious about climate change is the Pentagon. As early as 1998, the Defense Department identified climate change as a challenge. This is changing under the Trump administration. The investigative climate outlet Floodlight reports the Pentagon is cutting hundreds of millions of dollars from its climate change research. Ames Alexander reported that story.
For the Pentagon, this has not chiefly been about concerns about the environment. It's about how and where troops can effectively operate. They've been concerned about making flood-prone bases more climate resilient, ensuring that troops don't suffer heat exhaustion or heat stroke, and anticipating the way equipment functions in extreme heat. Military planes can't carry as heavy loads, for instance. Naval ships can't cool their engines as effectively. Arctic ice melt can even compromise the effectiveness of sonar.
And you've seen this already.
Yeah, I mean, a few examples. During the 2016 raid to capture Osama bin Laden, one of those Black Hawk helicopters was severely damaged during a hard landing. And President Obama said at the time that the hot temperature helped lead to that incident. Helicopters and planes have a harder time generating lift when the temperature is extremely high. Another example, 2023, Typhoon Mawar clobbered Anderson Air Force Base in Guam. That cost nearly $10 billion to repair and harden the base against future extreme weather events.
Let's look at the numbers. I mean, the new War Department budget is slashing $1.6 billion for climate research and adaptation planning. What specifically was this money earmarked for?
So a little bit of that is a mystery. They have not spelled out exactly what would make up that $1.6 billion. We know that one of the targeted programs is a $6 million grant to decarbonize emissions from Navy ships. We know that the Pentagon has canceled 91 studies focused on climate and social science research. One example of that, Virginia Tech and the nonprofit Center for Climate and Security were slated to get $2 million to study how rising seas and extreme weather could fuel instability in the Philippines, Guam, and Japan. And those are places that are obviously important to U.S. strategy in the Indo-Pacific.
And that seems like important research. What is the justification given by the Trump White House for these cuts?
There is little justification other than that climate change is a distraction. I did reach out to the Pentagon for an interview. I also filed a Freedom of Information Act request for documents related to all of this. The Pentagon did not respond. It seems as though it's tied to the administration's general skepticism about climate change and the belief that, you know, it's all a green new scam, as they put it.
What do you think is the potential impact of these cuts on the international stage?
Well, A few things. I mean, certainly, I think it sends a message to some of our competitors and adversaries that we have a vulnerability. It's important to know that military leaders in other countries, including Russia and China, are preparing for climate change. And if our military doesn't do that, it puts us at a disadvantage. Let's say a foreign force wanted to attack an overseas base, and let's say they knew the base was not sufficiently designed to withstand a hurricane. What better time for them to attack than right after a hurricane, right?
I think you're kind of edging into what the Department of Defense has long called climate change, a threat multiplier.
Yes, exactly right. Exactly right. I think that you can't really come to any other conclusion.
Ames Alexander is a reporter with Floodlight, an investigative news outlet covering climate change.
Fishing gear and other plastic trash washes into the ocean from boats and coastlines all over the planet. Surprisingly, perhaps it is in landlocked Nebraska where a company is trying to prove that plastic can be put to use. Nebraska Public Media's Cassidy Arena has our story.
When people walk into the recycling facility of First Star Fiber in Omaha, they'll see bags of trash from floor to ceiling. But it's not going to a landfill.
What makes First Star Recycling unique is then we take hard-to-recycle plastics.
That's Patrick Leahy. He's the CEO.
We take those, re-recycle them. We make plastic lumber or pellets with it.
Leahy says this Omaha company is one of few in the U.S. that recycles discarded fishing gear, not just nets, but ropes, dock lines. And that's why, from nearly 4,000 miles away, the Hawaii Pacific University Center for Marine Debris Research in Honolulu got in touch. The center partners with organizations that together pull nearly 200 tons of discarded plastic from the ocean every year, most of it fishing gear. That's from all over the world, especially a highly concentrated floating trash pile known as the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Although Nebraska is the farthest state from any coast in all directions, the landlocked state can still have an impact on the world's oceans. And one way to do that is to make retired fishing materials into usable plastic.
So the plastic pollution problem in the ocean is transboundary.
Jennifer Lynch is a research biologist and the co-director of the Center for Marine Debris Research. She says fishermen's nets can get tangled, lost, or caught in propellers, and are often cut and released once they're tangled and no longer of use.
Because we have to remove all of this to protect our coral reefs and our sea turtles, we're left with a giant burden of this trash. The world's trash is washing up on our shores.
So Leahy and Gubbles' team is turning that fishing gear into a type of durable plastic lumber.
What we're looking for is Play-Doh. Too much liquid, as you can see. That's what will show up in the board.
This isn't going to be a long-lasting project, Leahy says. It's expensive to send the fishing gear all the way to Omaha, and it costs money to run the equipment to make it into lumber. The project at this point is mostly about proving that their technology can help find a solution to ocean litter.
This is a trial to see if we can do it closer to the source of the plastics. That's what's needed. When it comes to waste, you don't want to move it a bunch of times. You want to handle it where it's generated.
Researcher Jennifer Lynch says while you can buy new plastic for around $400 a ton, it costs about $5,000 to remove it from the ocean. Mafalda De Freitas is also at the Center for Marine Debris Research. As an environmental scientist, she works with teams to remove plastic from the shores.
Recycling is never going to be the next Amazon. It's not going to be a unicorn business, super lucrative. It is more of a public service, such as that we're protecting the environment.
So far, First Star Fiber hasn't quite gotten the formula 100% down. So some of the pilot plastic lumber boards are a bit wiggly.
I mean, the weaker the material is, unfortunately, it's going to be
But some are ready to turn into building material and be sent back to the Aloha State, where the hope is they'll be used to help rebuild Maui after the devastating wildfires 2 years ago. For The World, I'm Cassidy Arena, Omaha, Nebraska.
We've got more stories coming up. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Christo Grozev has established himself as a skilled investigator of international criminals, especially those connected to the regime of Russian leader Vladimir Putin. Grozev famously revealed the culprits who poisoned Putin's best-known critic, Alexei Navalny. Now he's working with several media outlets on a new investigation, and it leads straight into Russian intelligence operations.
Grozev is working with Der Spiegel in Germany, The Insider, a Russian dissident news outlet, and our GBH colleagues at Frontline. Grozev spoke with me last week here in our Boston studio. Christo, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Your investigation focuses on an Austrian man named Jan Marsalek. He is wanted in Germany for a huge financial fraud case. Folks might remember it from when it was in the headlines a handful of years ago. Explain why German law enforcement wants him.
First of all, you'll see his face at every airport in Germany, getting in or getting out. He's literally the Germany's most wanted man. He'd made his fame in Germany by becoming kind of the wunderkind of German fintech. The company that he co-founded or made into the starling of Germany, fintech, is something like the German PayPal, right? And he was the beloved young entrepreneur of Chancellor Merkel, of many other government officials before that. They were parading him around the world until one day the company just collapsed. That was in the middle of 2020. The company dissipated into thin air with more than $2.5 billion off its balance sheet, that money that could never be found. So the whole investigation had started earlier because of an investigative journalist from the Financial Times who had looked into that company and thought that all of the bank accounts are kind of cooked and nothing makes sense.
Something didn't add up.
Right, didn't add up. And but then in June 2020, the auditors actually agreed with the investigating journalist saying, no, we don't see the money. We can't reendorse the annual accounts. On that day, everything imploded. And Jan Marsalek, the COO of this company, just vanished into thin air. The whole world started looking where he went. I discovered of his existence on that day. I had not followed the financial story of Wirecard before that. And I started looking for him because a lot of colleagues reached out to me and said, well, you're good at discovering people who disappear. Can you help us find this guy? So we looked for him in Asia because he had left some traces or false tracks as if he disappeared into Asia. We looked for him in Africa. And then we decided to check, maybe he's just vanished into Russia, which is where I have a lot of competence in finding people, and we found him there. So that's how my story with tracking Jan Marsalek started almost 5 years ago.
And so you find him in Moscow. You discover that he is involved with Russian intelligence services. How did he get involved with Russian intelligence services, the FSB?
When we published our first finding that he actually fled to Russia, initially to Belarus and from there to Russia, we discovered a strange pattern of visits to Russia that predated that escape by 10 years. So since 2014, he had traveled to Russia more than 70 times, and nobody in his company knew about those trips. And we started finding overlaps between those trips and certain other events. One of the trips we found that he had taken to Syria overlapped with trips of Russian intelligence officers to that country. And slowly we started unpeeling this onion and finding that he had made himself available to Russian intelligence for years before he escaped. But the big question was, where did he vanish? Was Russia still using him? Is he just an exile, or is he continuing to do some operations? And for about 4 years, this was the question that both German law enforcement and intelligence officers and investigative journalists were looking for answers on, until this investigation found the answer. We found him literally working for Russian intelligence, going to the office of the former KGB, the current FSB, almost on a daily basis. And we could visualize that by finding his photos in the streets of Moscow and going to this office of the headquarters of the FSB on street cameras that we got access to. So probably the most fun part of this investigation was that we were able to use the surveillance system that the Russian intelligence service uses on their own citizens to find out actually one of their operatives strolling through Moscow.
Turn it against them a little bit.
Correct.
So if you have been able to find him, is Germany looking for him to try to prosecute him for his crimes?
Well, that's the $2.5 billion question here, because Germany, on the surface of it, is looking for where the money went and is looking for answers. But I cannot imagine that they would still be at the loss of where he is. If we were able to find him, And that was part of the reason for this very visual investigation. We wanted to shame the German government into action, because once you show him in the streets of Moscow, they can no longer say, oh, we don't know where he is. And maybe the wheels of law enforcement will start turning a bit faster now that we've shown him there.
You say you want to shame Germany into acting. Can you guess why Germany has not done the work that you have done to find and potentially apprehend Marsalek?
I can only quote a recent statement by Marsalek to somebody. I cannot identify the person to whom he said that, but his words were, Germany is the last country that wants me back. I know too much. And I think there may be some truth to that. I mean, with all of his proximity to politicians, with all of his access to cash, it could be that he has what they call in Russia compromising material on German politicians that may make them reluctant to actually try to get him back.
So back to his work with the FSB, your reporting shows that he was involved with the FSB for many years prior to his disappearance. So while he was the COO of this big financial firm in Germany, he was working with the FSB.
Correct. And that work constituted, assistance to Russian intelligence on many, many levels. Let's start with the most obvious. Like, he was sitting on top of a lot of transaction data, payments. The company that he was running was a payments implementation system. He had access to bank accounts or bank transfers of millions and millions of customers. Many of them were actually Western intelligence officers who trusted that company because it was Germany's darling company. So German intelligence used that company for their own payments. American intelligence officers often used that company because it was kind of on the borderline between a bank and a non-banking institution, a lot more freedom in where they could make payments to. So he was sitting on all of that data, and arguably Russia would have access to that through him. But further, more than that, he was able to bribe, and this has been proven in court now, he was able to bribe intelligence officers in Austria, his home country, and in Germany in order to get them to work for the Russians. And one of the strange incident of what discoveries in this investigation of mine was that he had actually bribed an Austrian police officer to spy on me and on other opposition or anti-Putin, as they call it, journalists living in Austria.
Because you are wanted by Russia for your work investigating Navalny, among other things.
So this became a very meta investigation, because I just found out in the middle of my own investigation that he had been helping the investigation against me. And more than that, it was later discovered that he had essentially run his own sub-intelligence unit that had been spying on me and my family for about 3 years. And I had no idea that that was happening.
There are famous cases of Russian agents poisoning and killing dissidents in Western countries. I gather that Marsalek is connected to some of those cases. Can you explain how?
Marsalek personally boasted about having the formula for Novichok, the actual secret formula of the toxin that killed that almost killed Alexei Navalny and that almost killed the Skripals in 2018. And again, that showed some proximity to the operatives who would have conducted that operation. There's another incident of global proportions that we have discovered that he was involved with, much closer than that, that had to do with poisonings. But I will abstain from naming that incident because we are continuing the investigation. We plan to publish it, but that is coming up in the future.
We're listening to Christo Grozev, the investigator who's risen to prominence tracking down international criminals, particularly people with ties to the Russian government.
He's describing an ongoing investigation he's working on. It's a collaboration with our colleagues at GBH's Frontline and other news outlets that digs into the case of Jan Marsalek. He's wanted by the authorities in Germany for a $2.5 billion financial fraud. Grozev has confirmed that Marsalek has been in Moscow and he's connected to Russian intelligence services.
One of the hallmarks of Grozev's investigations is using technology to trace and confirm criminal activity. In our conversation last week, he explained how that worked in this investigation. You mentioned these surveillance cameras that are all over Moscow that you have kind of been able to turn against the surveillance state. You have been tracking Jan Marsalek's movements with considerable precision. What other tools and methods have you used to do that?
Well, first of all, one thing I should say is that Jan Marsalek had a certain protection from being surveilled. His face was included in faces that cannot be looked up using the surveillance system, which again points to the fact that he was an operative of Russian intelligence. But we discovered this little workaround, which is that once we knew whom he's dating, we were able to actually look up the face of his girlfriend. And there he was next to her in multiple places in Moscow. Something that we also discovered in that process was that he was weaponizing his relationship with his girlfriend. And he had turned her into a spy as well. And she was careering a lot of the money and items that he needed in his intelligence work to European countries, because he can't travel anymore now that his face is plastered all over airports. But we discovered also something very interesting, which was that in addition to his espionage work, he was actually a participant. He is a participant in the war against Ukraine. We found that he traveled multiple times across the border into Ukraine in the company of mercenaries, in the company of soldiers. And the only explanation we could find out, and it was verified by intelligence sources in Russia, was that he's in fact participating as an sort of saboteur, an advanced intelligence officer on the front line in the war against Ukraine, which has led, interestingly, to consideration by Austria, which has only become known this week, that they might withdraw his citizenship, because under Austrian law, any citizen who fights for the armed forces of another state loses their citizenship automatically. So we might be in a situation where he has only a Russian citizenship to look forward to.
Right. How do you see justice ultimately being served here?
The ultimate goal is to discover the truth. Law enforcement and intelligence services have become lazy. Sometimes they are prevented from pushing for a particular outcome because of political reasons. Coming forward with a journalistic investigation that is transparent, can be replicated by others, would leave a lot more questions that need to be answered by law enforcement than before such investigations, such as why can we not do the same and retrace these steps. It's been a passion of mine to get impact from my investigations by causing law enforcement to act. And very often we've seen that impact where suddenly they decide, okay, we can do the same thing. We'll retrace the steps. We'll bring somebody to justice. I was one of our investigations at the time where I still worked for Bellingcat was into the assassination of a Chechen asylum seeker in Germany in 2019 in Berlin.
Bellingcat, the investigative organization that you led for many years.
And our investigation led directly to the indictment of the person as a Russian intelligence operative. And it was the first time that Germany in recent history had blamed the Russian state for a terrorist act on German territory. Mm-hmm. And this was directly connected to a journalistic investigation. So I think there can be more of that.
I want to go back a little bit in history. You uncovered and confirmed the plot to poison Russian dissident Alexei Navalny. What connects that investigation with this one, beyond the obvious that we've heard so far?
Well, there's one very direct connection. On the day that we published the investigation into Navalny's poisoning, which was, if I remember correctly, December 13, 2020, on that same day, Jan Marsalek, as we now know, tasked his network of freelance spies around Europe to start surveilling me and to follow me around. And he instructed them to gather any information on me that could be found, because his bosses at the FSB were very interested in this person. And there's clearly a connection with that investigation. And that makes sense, because of all the investigations that I've supervised, that was probably the most embarrassing one to President Putin, because not only did it disclose this operation, not only did that trick one of the operatives, one of the poisoners, into admitting, confessing in a call to the victim, to Alexei Navalny, that they had tried to poison him unsuccessfully, but it also forced Putin to have to explain himself at the annual press conference about this incident. Clearly, that was a heavy personal toil for Putin, and he tasked the FSB with, well, solving the problem. So yeah, that's a direct connection, because Marsalek went after me as a result of that investigation.
I imagine you're not doing any of this reporting inside of Russia. As you have mentioned, you are persona non grata, but you are still taking on considerable personal risk doing this work.
Yeah, that is correct. I mean, this same group of operatives broke into my apartment in Vienna when I used to live there in 2022. They tried to actively steal the laptop that they could see in the film Navalny, on which I was conducting the investigation into the Navalny poisoning, thinking that it contains all the secrets and all the whistleblowers' tips and all the whatever they imagined was on that computer. So that's a clear risk. It's a risk not just for me, but for my family. One of my children was at home during the break-in, and they didn't realize that he was
scary.
He was there. That was super scary. So that's a risk, and that probably drove my decision to also live separately from my family so that I can protect them. It's something you normalize, and you just continue living. And one of the things that I don't say frivolously is that once the risk is there, then at least I should make the most of this of this lifestyle, and I should investigate more, because the risk doesn't increase with new investigations. But it is probably the biggest cost. I mean, the risk to my life is nothing compared to that cost, as you could imagine. I missed my daughter's becoming an adult. I mean, I missed the best two years of my daughter's life.
So do you think that living separately from your family actually protects them?
I think it does. There are old rules of the game which suggest that they, even the worst of intelligence services, shouldn't go after family members frivolously. By accident, yes, but that's the accident that I'm trying to prevent by not being near them.
Mm.
But again, the rules of the game change, and after the war, after the invasion of Ukraine by Putin, reputation cost for Russia has kind of disappeared. So nobody knows what the new rules of the game is, but I just hope that even those operatives have some morals.
Christo Grozev is investigating the case of Jan Marsalek, an Austrian national with connections to Russian intelligence services. Christo, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
The latest in Grozev's ongoing investigation was just published by Der Spiegel and GBH's Frontline. Go to theworld.org to read the latest from them and watch Frontline's documentary about the first phase of this ongoing investigation. That is all for you at theworld.org.
In Mexico, authorities have deployed the military alongside civilian personnel to reopen roads in more than 300 communities that were flooded. Torrential rains and landslides in central and eastern parts of Mexico blocked transportation routes. At least 64 people have died so far, according to the Associated Press, but dozens more are missing, and the real extent of the damage is still unknown. The Mexican states of Hidalgo, Puebla, and Veracruz were hit hardest. President Claudia Sheinbaum said that reopening roads is a top priority and that the government will spare no expense responding to this emergency. You're listening to The World. Adopted kids often decide they want to know more about where they came from. Robin Reef adopted her daughter Rosie from China, an adoption that gave the family only scant information about her background. When Rosie started asking questions, it prompted mother and daughter to travel to China in search of a document that might tell them more. Robin Reef shared what they discovered on the trip with GBH's storytelling program, Stories from the Stage.
I think we can all agree that 7,000 miles is a long way to go for a little piece of paper. But that paper was a note that I was told was pinned to my daughter's sweater when she was found on a bridge as an infant in China. And I had been looking for that note ever since Rosie was placed in my arms. But the search got very real one day when she was around 3, and she explained to me, "Mom, you know, babies don't come from moms, they come from China." Oh, misunderstanding, sweetie. Yes, you come from China, we've always talked about that, but before that, you came from a mom. We have always said you were adopted. Oh, I thought you said I was a doctor. Well, we had the conversation yet again. It's not that we hadn't had it before, but this time she understood. And it was awful. Mom, mommy, why did she throw me away? Did she not like me? Mom, do you know her? Can we call her? I mean, it made my heart hurt, and I was more determined than ever to find that note, if only to prove to Rosie that her worst fears were not true. So, I wrote to her orphanage. I had done this before, but I did it again. Wrote to her orphanage, Nothing. I wrote to the Central China Adoption Authority, the bureaucrats in Beijing who match you. Silence. I spoke to adoption officials here who spoke to adoption officials there. Got nothing. So by the time we were able to get back to China to look ourselves, Rosie was 11. And she wasn't really talking a lot about her birth mother. She was obsessed with the Hunger Games and begging me to get a dog. I said, we're going, no matter what. And after a long ride, and I mean 3 beers, pass out, panic attack, finish War and Peace long, we get to Nanjing. Next day, freezing January day, we take off for Yixing, the city where she was found. Our first stop is Huidi Bridge, the exact spot where she was found. Now, I had always pictured a beautiful crescent bridge, like in the ancient Chinese paintings. Yeah, well, Huidi is a concrete slab over a polluted canal, but it was our sacred spot. So we stood there. Again, it's a freezing day. We're on the bridge. It's very gray. I look at Rosie. She looks kind of teary. Oh, honey, I know. This is hard. Mommy, Mom, this is so boring. Well, our next stop, I was so excited, was the police station. It was where she was taken after she was found, and we had never been able to identify it, but our translator found the precinct. And it had to be there. It was the only place it could be. So we get there, we are sent up and down and back and forth, and I'm getting anxious, I'm getting hot. Finally, we are sent to the office of the one person we're told can help. And I pour out my tearful request. And she smiles, my heart lifts. And she says, oh, all records before 2005 were lost in a fire. Oh, you heartless witch, you witch. How can you smile? Life was lost in that fire. A part of my daughter was lost in that fire. And I'm thinking, I have no tools here. I can't ask for the manager. I don't speak Mandarin. I can't cry because, yeah, who's going to be sorry for a white lady from New York? I have nothing. And Rosie is saying, Mom, stop it. We're going to get arrested. It's the police. They're going to put us in jail. And our translator is saying, okay, we're going now. And she has her foot in my back, and we are out the door. And we have to show up at the orphanage where the note is not, as I know. We have lunch with the new director. And as we're leaving, she hands me this file. I'm telling you, it's the size of a suitcase. It's enormous. And I had to put it on the table in order to leaf through it. And what I see were adoption papers that I had signed 10 years ago. So I'm thinking, this is weird. So I'm paging through, and I see, stuck between two pages, is this ripped out, crumpled piece of paper with these sort of ballpoint marks, and I take it out gingerly because I don't want to rip it anymore, and I see Mandarin characters and numbers, and I see, well, I'm able to make out Rosie's date of birth, which of course I knew, and then the exact time of her birth, which only her birth parents could possibly know. It was the note. I hand it to Rosie. She looks at it, hands it back with this look like, yeah, Mom, but what I really, really want is a dog. So we're in the car. She's giving me grief. Mom, the note said nothing. So why did we even come? It's like, oh, honey, I know. It's disappointing. But the truth is, I was not disappointed. I got what I came for because that note answered a question I never would have dared ask out loud. That note was proof that Rosie was not trafficked and so was not someone's stolen daughter. Rosie was not left to die, as had been so many girls during the one-child policy years. Rosie was left to be found. Thank you.
Wow. Robin Reef is a writer from New York City. Her story and many others produced by her partners at GBH's Stories from the Stage.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and be sure to subscribe to our new YouTube channel as well. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening. Please join us again tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Jake Shapiro and Elizabeth Hansen, Jamel and Tom Perkins, John and Jill Gilbert, Lynn Brody, and Stephanie Gardner. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.